Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another great edition we have here of Suspense Radio on a fabulous Tuesday night. I am your host, John Robb. We are going to have an exciting guest for us, tonight. Author CJ West, entrepreneur, everything in between, a lot of different events and things CJ does, as well also with his radio show, his marketing. We're going to get into his books. We're going to get into publishing. We're going to get into social networking, marketing, the whole gamut of everything going on here, and nobody better than CJ to kind of share that with. So it's time for everything that is suspense, mystery, thrill, horror, you hear right here on Suspense Radio, and it begins right now.
But our magazine is out there. Hopefully our December issue
I think is in everybody's hands, in everybody's stores. We sell out all over the shelves, and we just make January that much bigger, which is being printed, and it will have kind of our year preview of what, you know, 2011, along with Stuart Woods, Jeffrey Deaver, Brett Messler. Exclusive interviews are going to be included in there. Like we mentioned before, we're going to have exciting guests coming up in 2011. We are going to have Brad Messler come on the radio show with us sometime, hopefully in February. We are going to have Stephen King joining us. We know we got that one coming. We also know that we are going to have Laurel K. Hamilton join us on the radio, so we're not sure when that's going to happen. But we did get the okay for working on that. She's just working on her book. So, you know, Clive Cussler, we're going to redo John Saul, and, you know, a lot of great guests coming up that everybody can listen to. But now what I want to do is we're just going to bring, you know, our main guest in tonight, which is CJ. And we met CJ first at VoucherCon. I followed him here on Blog Talk Radio with his great show that he has going on. And so, CJ, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. How you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me on the show. It's exciting to be on Suspense Radio.
Yeah, you just never know what door we're going to open or what's going to come out, which is, I think, is what's really exciting, which is kind of how your books are and your standalone suspense book that you have. You kind of took a little bit of a break from your Randy Black character. You did a book called The End of Marking Time. So this is your fifth book. So can you kind of tell everybody a little bit about this one? And, you know, the concept behind it is fascinating and also extremely damn scary, to tell you the truth.
Thanks, John. Yeah, The End of Marking Time is a different book for me. It's a break from my Randy Black series. And I wanted to give people an entry point into my book that was current. People kept going back to Sin and Vengeance. That book was optioned for film, and it's the beginning of my Randy Black series. The End of Marking Time is quite a different book. It's a bit on the experimental side. The entire book takes place in about 3 hours, and it's told to you by Michael O'Connor, who's talking to you as if you know who he is, which is a little unsettling. Michael is trapped in a plexiglass box in the basement of a monitoring center, and he's asking you to set him free. He believes that you're his jury, and he's talking to a window that he believes you're behind, and as you're reading, he's telling you his story. So as you're reading along, you're listening to what has happened to him, which is a little unsettling, but you're also wondering, you know, who's behind this window and what are they going to do to Michael? And you get that at the very end of the book. So yeah, it's a little experimental, a little different for me, but I like to do that with my books. I like to take each book in the direction of the subject matter and really let that dictate the tone and the structure of the book.
Yeah. What made you, I guess, decide to go away a little bit from, you know, from Randy? Were you just, you know, was this a story that was in your head that you decided that you had to get out?
Yeah, well, this was a very special book for me. Normally, I am a plotter, and we can talk about that, but the way I work is I work on a storyboard, and I do an outline and character biography typically, and I do that for about 3 months into the book. So I really have the story down before writing. The End of Marking Time was a book that just really grabbed me. I sat down to write what was going to be the first chapter, and 6 weeks later, I had the entire first draft, which is crazy fast. I mean, I've never written that fast. My forearms were hurting as I had to put that. So it was a very special book for me. I think my best day was almost 10,000 words. For those of you who aren't writers, that's a tenth of a novel. So if I did that for 10 days, I would be done.
Wow. That is definitely cranking out when you're talking. I mean, I see on Facebook where people are saying, you know, cranking out is 50,000 words a month. You're doing 10,000 a day. I mean, that's just, I mean,
well,
yeah.
Yeah, like I said, it was a very special book. It seemed like, I had this idea. The idea is Michael is a criminal, and he's been a criminal all his life. And what I wanted to do was explore who he was and how he became that way. And I did that with a re-education program that was designed to help him become a productive member of society, basically. So it's a replacement for our modern-day prison system. And as I wrote the book, it really sort of wrote itself. I mean, I know you hear people say that, but as I went through, every time I needed a new chapter, a new scene, they just came to me and exploded onto the page, and it was really amazing how fast the book churned out. Compare that to my normal production, it usually takes me 14 months to write a book. This book, with editing, even back and forth with my editors and my the folks who helped me put books together, it was really only a four-month process from beginning to end.
And, you know, like we mentioned before, you're your own publisher. I mean, literally, your books are published by 22 West Books, which is your company. And
yes.
You're probably the only author that I know that does it this way, which, you know, you're your own editor, you're your own marketer, you're your own designer, you're everything, you know, to your company.
Well, I do, you know, there are some things that I farm out. I don't feel comfortable putting out a book that hasn't gone through an independent editor. So I do hire an editor at least once for every book. Typically, my books go through about 6 or 7 sets of eyes before they see readers. And I also have a cover artist who works at one of the big publishers who I really like. And she does my cover art and my promotional stuff for me. So I do farm some of that stuff out, but I think we're going to see more and more of this. One of the writers that I really admire, Tim Hallinan, I helped him with a project recently. I read something for him that was going out. It was a book that he produced for exclusively for Kindle. He didn't go through his publisher. He popped it right onto Kindle, and the book is out and selling. And I think with the explosion in Kindle you're going to see this year, I think more and more authors are going to be doing that. They're going to be grabbing hold of what they see is an exploding market and doing it without their publisher and traditional editor.
Well, yeah, you say you farm things out, but the good thing that you have is you have total control pretty much of, you know, let's just say the name of your book, what goes on your book, you know, the book cover in general, all of that, where, you know, we've talked to a lot of authors and they come back and they say, okay, here's 50 choices for a book cover. It's like, well, I really don't like any of them. It's like, well, you got to pick one because that's all we're going with.
Right.
You know, they kind of tell them what to do. And I do agree. I was just on Publishers Weekly today and I noticed that book sales, not book sales, but bookstore sales, have declined, and they keep declining. And then I saw on the flip side where Amazon is saying that their Kindle sales, they can't keep them in the store. So I kind of think to myself, is bookstore sales declining because Kindles and e-readers are getting more popular, and is that going to be more of the trend, which, like I mentioned, is the same thing when you walk into a Best Buy and see how many CDs they have now.
Yeah,
why do you need CDs?
Yeah, there's something happening here for sure. I did a blog on e-books for the Stiletto Gang, and I can't remember the date. I think it was in November, but I can't remember the exact date. One of the things I mentioned was hardcover sales this year are down 40%, and e-book sales are up 158%. So it's clear to me that e-books are eroding those sales, and readers are looking for bargains. You know, it's a tough economy out there. And I think it's just a matter of time before they find the vehicle to find authors like me who are professional writers, but who are offering books for $2.99 as opposed
right.
to, you know, you saw Ken Follett's book come out for $19.99 as an ebook, which is just criminal. You know, there's
right.
the publishers making $15 a copy on that, which really, in my mind, is just criminal.
Well, with no printing costs.
Well, exactly. You know, the cost to deliver a book the size of my typical 300-page, 6x9 trade paperback is 6 cents. That's what it costs Amazon to deliver that book. Now, there might be some storage costs associated with that as well, but, you know, there really is no cost. There's no cost to return. So I think one of the game changers here, if you think about it, is that you look at an e-book for $3. $2.10 of that is going through the writer or publisher.
Right.
So that's taking out a lot of people out of the middle, which is difficult. You know, independent bookstores are struggling. Folks who are, you know, in the paper business and the shipping business are struggling as a result.
Right.
But it's really sending the customer's dollars right directly to the author, which I think is a wonderful thing. I think that's going to mean that a lot more authors are going to be able to make a living doing what they love, and then you're going to see a whole lot more production.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, there's always a good with the bad, and of course, like you mentioned, what the bad is that printers and shippers and things like that are going to have a lot less work and, you know, maybe have to lay people off and do things like that. But on the flip side, if things are a lot more digital, you know, you're going to have more jobs created on that line, so there's a lot more tech-savvy positions that are going to be more manual labor positions. And, you know, that's just going to go hand-in-hand with what's going to happen in the future. Like I mentioned, I would much rather have an e-book than a hard book, just because I don't need 500 books sitting around my house in boxes and shelves and closets and whatnot, making all this room, you know. I'd rather much have it on my e-reader, where it's all right in front of me. And
no, John, I never would have believed that. I was asked to host the e-book panel at BoucherCon this year, and part of doing that is I went out to all of my panelists and purchased their e-books and took a look at them, and I discovered something that really surprised me. I enjoy reading e-books more than the hardcover.
Me too.
Because people, you know, I do a radio show. I do a show here on Blog Talk Radio. And I get hardcovers from the publishers, and I have piles of them everywhere. And I can keep all those books on my Kindle, and they're out of the way. You know, if I happen to be in the supermarket and I want to just read a little bit of something, or if I want a sample, which I love the sample books, I can do it anywhere, anytime. It's just fantastic. And I think the more people who realize that, the more Kindle you're going to sell as a result. And it's going to be this reinforcing cycle. Just going to see a huge proliferation of those devices.
Right. I mean, you know, with our magazine, of course, I mean, we average about 50 books a week that we get in from wherever, you know, from whether it's independent authors sending us their books or whoever sending it to us. We get about 50 books a week sent to us. And, you know, we send them out to the reviewers, but we have probably about 400 right now sitting around, 400 to 450 probably just sitting there that haven't been able to go out. They're just taking up all this space. I probably have about 2,500 books in my house alone, just whatever. I'd much rather be able to have all of that accessibility in one place. I mean, let's just face it. So with Martha Stewart, she's all about organization. Isn't that what it's about? And heck,
right.
let's save some trees. Let's be environmentally green.
You know, the other thing that's great, John, is that for me as a writer, it doesn't cost me anything to give away a free book. And I saw someone post something about, she posted a note about her husband in Afghanistan. And I sent her a note on Facebook and said, you'll give me an email address, I'll send you my latest book for him, because she was getting him a Kindle. You know, and that cost me nothing. I was delighted to do that. And I think it's a great thing for writers to get their work out there in the market. Sending those files to someone through email costs zero.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. I mean, just look at it from a straight business sense, like you as a publisher. How much money would you save if you never had to print a paperback and you only did e-books?
It's a huge savings. You know, another thing that I think a lot of people miss, John, if you compare me to someone like Dan Brown, Dan Brown is in all of the big bookstores. He's in Walmart, he's in Sam's Club. And his books are, you know, his trade paperback is probably $9 or $10. You know, for someone like me or, you know, my peers, L.J. Sellers or Simon Wood or somebody like that, we're not in Sam's Club. We're not in Barnes & Noble. You can't even find us.
No.
And even if you could, you know, if you went to the counter and you begged them for special order, the book would end up being $16. Right? So
right.
It's really not a level playing field. Now, if you look at Kindle, if you look at LJ's books, or Simon's books, or my books, they're $2.99, or you might catch them on special for a dollar.
Exactly.
Right? Where Dan Brown's book, did actually come down to $3.99, but most of the big guys you're going to see up there at $9 or $7. So the
right.
Kindle actually gives us a cost advantage as an indie author, and I think that's going to help level the playing field for us and help us make inroads into the market.
Well, and the thing that I preach, and I preach it a lot, and I always try to let as many people as I can know this. When you walk into a Barnes & Noble and you have 20, let's say you've got 30 bucks in your pocket and you're going to spend $30 on books, they put in the front of that, you know, right in the front when you walk in, those tables of the brand new hardbacks, and people don't realize that the publisher is paid to have them there. So it's not Barnes & Noble telling you this is what you should read, it's the publisher. And a lot of people stop right there, spend their $30 in that hardback instead of going back to the stacks to find other authors taking their time and reading and doing their research. They just take what's in front of them. Where I think, you know, when you look at the ebooks and you look at the Kindle, if you're spending $1.99 or $2.99, you're going to have a lot better chance of saying, I'm going to just spend $1.99 because if it's good, I spend $1.99, I just find a new author. If it's not good, I spend $1.99, and then, you know, that's no big deal. So I think that helps a lot. And how many bookstores do you walk into hand you free books where Amazon and the Kindle and other places have free books?
Right, hundreds.
They never handed me a free one.
Right. You know, the other thing that I love about the Kindle, too, is, you know, some people write off the reviews that are there written by other readers, but I think if you look at them critically, they're very, very valuable. You know, you walk into Barnes & Noble and you see something that's hyped by the publisher, you have no idea what anyone else has said about that. But, you know, you go to Amazon and you read reviews, or you listen to shows like this or blogs, you can get a good sense of what the book's about and that, you know, if this blogger is someone you trust or the host is someone you trust, that it's a good book.
Yeah, and, you know, and the funny thing is I'm looking, and I kind of look at the chat, and I kind of have some people on here, and they're saying, you know, that they collect first edition paperbacks and things like that, you know, which I think is great, or, you know, hardcovers, and then the authors, you know, can go out, and they can find them for them, and this and that. But I guess if you're a collector, that's a different thing, and, you know, that'll probably always be there, like comic books, you know, people collect comic books. But what do you really do with those editions? I mean, are you using them to sell them? You know, do you need the autograph of an author in the book? I mean, it doesn't do anything except you're meeting the author, but there would be no different as, you know, being able to sit there and buy the Kindle, going up, meet the author, saying hi to them, and, you know, this and that. I mean, I guess it's the same thing. So I don't really get the pull on that one.
Well, you know what's funny? I love ebooks. I also collect signed books by authors that I either admire or that I know. You know, friends of mine, I have their signed books here on my shelf. And, you know, guys like Michael Connelly or Lee Child, I have their books on my shelf as well.
Now, somebody wants to know, out of your opinion, because I always say that I prefer the Sony e-reader because it's like a little mini computer to me. I can do Dolby Digital editions and PDFs and everything else, where, like, the Nook could not do. And I don't know anything about the Kindle because I didn't see it. But which of the readers do you, you know, have you practiced on? Do you prefer Kindle, Nook, or Sony e-reader?
Well, I'll tell you, at the e-book forum that I did in San Francisco, I think it was, someone brought an iPhone, he had a Kindle and a Nook. And I demonstrated those for folks who wanted to check those out. I have a Kindle. And the reason I have a Kindle is because I prefer the publishing platform, and I find that authors produce books for Kindle first. And I'm talking about small authors. You know, authors who are my peers will produce a book for Kindle, and then they'll work on all of those formats at some point later on. It might be a month, it might be 6 months before they come out. But the Kindle book is typically the first because it's the biggest market. And that's the reader that I bought, and that's the reader that I bought.
Right, yeah, and I because it's Amazon, and it's definitely the largest market to have out there, and so people would do that one first. The reason why, I prefer the e-reader is because now I can get people to send me their PDFs, and then it'll jump it right on there, and I can go ahead and read it right away without having to worry about
You could do that with a Kindle. It's just not as expensive.
Really?
Yes, on my Kindle. Yeah, you have to use it landscaped, and the scaling is perfect, but it does work. And there's another thing that's going on lately. I don't know if you saw this, but the Google Books project is not supporting Kindle at this point. That requires a connection to the cloud. I don't know the technical details, but I do know that Kindle is not supported yet, and that could be an issue 6 months from now. But I have been sort of monitoring the Kindle sales by this tricky little backdoor method that I have.
Yeah.
And I will say that the sales are just tremendous at this point. I see literally tens of thousands of people flooding into Amazon forums right now.
Yeah, and I didn't know, and I have been following the Google thing because, you know, we take our magazine now and we make it, you know, let's try to make it on every reader we can so people can download it right away onto their reader. Not a big fan, I don't think, of how magazines look just because the pictures don't come in and you don't quite get that same kind of dynamic thing. But if you're just there to read it, it's good and it does what it's supposed to do because you can still read everything. You just can't quite get the, you know, the dynamic of it. I will say that the Nook in color, I think, is really cool looking. And it's in color, I mean, so, you know, it looks good. The iPad, I think, is probably the best, but it's always the most expensive. But it's,
yeah, you know, I had an iPad, actually, and I gave my iPad away because... I gave my iPad away because I went to read that out in the sun one day, and I couldn't read anything on it.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So it really did not work for me as a reader. And I want to jump here and answer a question in the forum, if that's okay, John.
Yeah.
So, I'm used to being host, so pardon me.
I know, so you're good at the chat thing. You're doing it.
Someone's asking if I publish POD as well as digital. And yes, I do. I use Lightning Source, who I really like. They have the Espresso Book Machine, which I think is the best solution for small bookstores. It lets them compete with Amazon in terms of selection, which there is no other solution that I see that allows them to do that except for ebooks. But the cool thing about the Espresso machine is you order something and it prints and it comes out of the machine hot as a printed book right there in the store. So they're putting in paper as opposed to ordering books, and the books print right there on site. Very cool. They also give me distribution all over the world to English-speaking countries. I have people who have ordered my books in Germany, Australia, South America, Canada, and that all happens through my company, and it's very simple for me to do. So I really like Lightning Source, and I do print books in the 100 or 200 quantity and sell them at events. I do some events where I'll sell 100 books or so in a night.
Oh, wow. That's good. You know, you get a lot of authors. You get a lot of authors in those bookstores. They're like, yeah, you know, we might have 40 or 50 people that come in when we do a signed book plates or whatever.
Yeah, I do some events. I had an event. It was, I can't remember if it was the spring or not. I had an author pull me aside. He sold 40-something books, and he said that was one of the best events he'd ever done. And he really wanted to come back. He had a lot of fun. Some of my events, what I do is I structure in the purchase of a book. So it's a ticketed thing where people buy tickets, and part of the ticket price is a book from one of the authors. So everyone who shows up gets a book, and then we go and we do something really fun. And I think that's a way to connect writers to readers. And it's also a way for us to not be in salesman mode all night. We're in fun mode, you know, during the event. No, we're not trying to sell books because they're already sold. We just sign them and have fun with our guests.
Well, I want to tell everybody here that is not listening live and going to come back and listen to it is your website is 22, and that's the number, 22wb.com, and people can find out about, you know, like I said, you know, your 5 books, where you're going to be, your contest, the crazy little things that you do because you do, you know, some other, you know, weird, crazy little events. I'm not going to really say weird, but they are different because you do like live murder mystery events where you, you know, a lot of other things. You're doing a show here, I know, January 21st in Sandown, New Hampshire. Couldn't really probably pick out where that one is on the map.
You know, I do some crazy stuff. Murder mysteries first. I love the murder mysteries, and if you would have asked me if I would enjoy acting, I probably would have told you never on your life. But I was asked to do a murder mystery, and I have had an absolute ball. The guests have a fantastic time. I write them now, I produce them, and we'll get four authors together, put on the murder mystery, and everyone has a great time. And I will sell, 70 to 100 books in a night. And, the great thing about it is people come away, the venue, it works for them. The authors have fun and the readers have fun. And it's a profitable thing. So it's a great thing all around to have a lot of fun. One of my crazy events was the online murder mystery that I did for the end of March time. I had this great idea to reproduce the world of the book online on Facebook. And people can still see that on my website. If you go to 22wb.com, there's a link for the online mystery. And what I did was every day I wrote a piece of a story of a mystery and linked the characters on Facebook so people could... I'm seeing that people are having trouble hearing me in the chat. So I'll try to speak up. If you're still having trouble, can you just let me know that you can't hear me?
Yeah, I think sometimes you kind of go in and out. I don't know if it's the landline or how Blog Talk is. But so you were saying that you take your characters and you put them on Facebook, and you probably made their own Facebook page for them so people can kind of get the sense that they're real. Is that where you were going with it?
Right, and we had online chat. In the online chat, I was really amazed that people were flocking to these things. They lasted 4 or 5 hours at a time. It was crazy. And what happened, it was very successful, and maybe it was a little too successful. People wanted me there for crazy amounts of time, and I couldn't be there as much as they wanted me to be there, but the event was very successful. People had a lot of fun, and that mystery is still out there. You can read it if you'd like to. Again, it's on my website, ttwb.com. It was a lot of fun, but it was one of those crazy things that I got into and sort of took on a life of its own.
Now, here's something that I guess a lot of people would want to know, because they might not either have, maybe the money to start their own business like you did or this and that, but when you did your first book, which is called Taking Stock, and you decided that you were going to go this route, what do you think is probably your top three best marketing things that you did in order to start building your fan base now to get yourself out there and get yourself going?
The top three things I did, I don't think I did anything right when I first started. I'm a do-it-yourself. And I started writing. I love to write, and I still absolutely love to write. It's my favorite thing to do. And I discovered one day I had been writing every single day for 7 years. And that was about the time that I started publishing books. And I wrote Taking Stock, but that wasn't the first book that I published. I published a book called Sin and Vengeance.
Oh, okay.
And I did a cover that was terrible. The font was terrible. There were a bunch of typos in the book. And I put it out. People loved the book. And that book was actually an option for film. Someone contacted me, option for film. Right? I was amazed. And at that point, I started to take my writing more seriously as not just something that I was doing for fun, but something that might be a professional endeavor. So we went back and edited the book. We got a new cover. Was always with Lightning Source, so I'd say that was probably the smartest thing that I did, was to choose Lightning Source as a partner and do that. But my evolution into social marketing sort of flowed from the rage that I was getting about the book and the fact that someone wanted to make a movie out of it. So I really started getting more professional from that point on. And for me, it's really been learn as you go. I never really queried for agents and publishers. I have done that a little bit here and there between books, but I really like having control. One of the things we talked about earlier was, you know, covers and that sort of thing. I think one of the things I hear often complain about more than anything is the ability to write what they'd like to write. And that's the thing that I really appreciate, is that, you know, I had the idea for The End of Marquee Time. I sat down, and 4 months later, the book was finished. You know, I didn't need to go to my editor and beg them, you know, this is the book I want to write. Will you promote this book? Will you sell this book? You know, I go, I write the book, and I do.
Yeah, and I guess the biggest, I guess one of the nicest things is that, which I just found out about, and I'm sure, and I don't know why I didn't think about it, but I actually watch a show, because I'm a big hair band metal guy, and I love metal music, I love hard rock music, and there's a show on VH1 Classic called That Metal Show, and they actually had Slash on there, and he was talking about one of his friends that was in Guns N' Roses, who Izzy, if people know Guns N' Roses, don't know if they do or not, and he actually writes, he does his own music, does it all together, boom, and just sends it off to iTunes, and then it's available right away. Doesn't have to wait on a press CD or anything else, he just does his music, sends it, it's available. And the one thing that I always hear from authors is the same thing, is that when we interview them about their book, the one that just came out, their other one is already finished and sitting in their publishers or their editors, but it's still, you know, 12 months away before people even see it. But for you, with the control, you know, you had a book, you wrote it, boom, 4 months it was done, and you had it out, and therefore you can give people a lot more instant gratification when you write, because your books do come out much faster, because you're not waiting in line behind 35 other authors that the publisher has to get out.
Right. You know, that's true. That's good and bad. You know, one of the things that all those other authors get is publicity, promotion, shelf space, all really cool stuff that I don't really get. All of my publicity, promotion, et cetera, comes from me. So, yes, my books come out faster and I have a whole lot of control about what I write, how it looks, and where it's going to be promoted, which is great. And I do like the idea that when I'm done with the book and I'm doing shows to talk about the book, it's really fresh in mind because it's just come out. You know, I've just finished it, it's come out, and here I am talking about it.
Right, but now, the thing is that, you know, we were talking in BoucherCon also about marketing, and there's a lot of publishers nowadays, like we were talking Alan Jacobson, he actually was told, you know, big time author, you know, great author, he was actually told this time by his publisher, we're not going to fund your book tour. If you want to do it, you have to do it on your own. So they're losing a lot of that marketing that they used to get, and they're just having to do it on their own anyway, which is what, you know, you're doing. So, but they never had to do it, I don't think, in that capacity, so they really don't know how to do it. Like, you're a lot more well-versed in that, and I think that that's the biggest challenge that they're going to have in the future, is the publishers are going to be making, you know, having them say, you need to go market yourself, because I think 85% of the authors that come out of those big publishers don't get a lot of promotion outside the first, you know, 2 or 3 weeks that when their book comes out, then they're published at their publisher moves on to somebody else.
Well, you know, those publishers have to provide value, and, you know, I think really that's shelf space, because the authors in the e-book market can just sidestep them very easily.
Yep.
It does not cost a lot to put out an e-book, so I think the authors, the publishers have to provide that shelf space, and yeah, they're not providing a lot of marketing, but they are providing a lot of value there. And can I comment on one more thing in the chat room? I hate to keep doing this to your job.
Oh, yeah, no, this is what we love.
There's a conversation going around about metal bands in the chat room. And a really cool thing, the murder mystery show that I'm doing in January, I'm doing with a guy named Mike Gerard, and he is the lead singer for the band The Fools. Have you heard of The Fools?
I have heard of The Fools.
So they toured with guys like Bon Jovi and, I don't know if Metallica is one of the bands, but I had a whole list of bands they toured in, all bands that I listened to when I was younger. It's very cool. We're doing a rock and roll show, and I have this massive blonde wig. I'm kind of a short-haired, straight-laced kind of guy, but I have this massive blonde wig and this outfit I'm wearing for this thing. It's going to be a whole lot of fun, so I'm going to be a 90s or 80s metal guy.
There you go.
Coming up in January, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, you know, also is I think Daniel Palmer, John Conley, some other people who are doing this too, they're actually putting music with their books, and they're saying, here's the music that would go well with this book. Now, I think a lot of it is kind of classical that I've listened to, but still, it's the same thing where, you know, I think a lot of the music kind of overlaps a little into the books and, you know, movies and stuff like that too. So I love metal music. I'm just going to tell you right now, you know, Satriani, Vi, Vinnie Moore, Tony McAlpine, all the guitar players that we're talking about in the chat, I mean, I know them all. I mean, I'm a huge guitar guy, and that's just what I am. So.
Yeah, I love guitar, and I was a big metal guy. I don't know if I'm mellowing, but I've been listening to a lot of country lately. It's probably not going to win me a lot of fans in the chat room. But I have been listening to a lot of country lately the last few years.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just a resurgence or whatnot, but I like to go back and see those artists come back, like the Queensrÿches and the Rats and the Dawkins, and, you know, because they still play great music, and I don't think that, I think the era of the 80s is the best music ever, and it will always stay that way. I don't think it's going to change.
Well, I think that's because that's when we grew up.
I think so, too, but I also think even today, everything is so, hey, if we're talking about digital, even the music today is so digitally enhanced, you don't even know what the artist, you know, the Katy Perrys or whoever, what do they actually sound like when they have to sing? I mean,
right.
We know Ashley Simpson can't do it, so we heard her sing.
I have to give my daughter a plug here.
Yes.
My daughter is Hallie West, and she's a budding singer, and she's quite talented. She does pop and a little bit of country, and you can find her through my Facebook page if you're looking for her. She has some great stuff out on YouTube, and we're actually going to do an album for her sometime this spring.
Well, and that's the thing. I just found out that now you can publish all that stuff straight to iTunes, which is probably a lot cheaper than going into doing studio time and everything else, or I'm sure you still have to do all of that and get it all worked out, but, you know, and having someone else gouge your music, but, you know, you can do it straight out to iTunes and have it done, you know, right away. Is that the route you guys were thinking of doing, too?
Well, you know, we're going to apply my sort of method to her work. We're going to go in, you know, she has an instructor who can also produce, and we're going to hire some musicians to help back her up, and we're going to create some songs that she's written, and then we're going to produce them ourselves, and then pay to have them produced, and then we're going to go either to iTunes or we'll start selling CDs or however that works, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's exciting time. I think that the digital age is great for, you know, really everything, because you can get it so much faster. I mean, you know, for all those people, here's the thing. How long, why do you not have an e-reader is probably how long did it take you to get an iPod, okay? Because if you don't have an iPod, you know, you're probably, now you're definitely in the minority of not even having an iPod. But you're going to be in the next, you know, couple years being a minority if you don't have an e-reader. Going to be the same thing, so I would get on the bandwagon now to start checking it out and getting it going, because that's the way you're going to see it. I mean, just walk. How many independent music stores are there anymore? None. You can't even go to a mall and find a CD in any mall. Or books. Malls are all closed. I was walking through the mall for Christmas. I couldn't find a bookstore or a CD store or a movie store to save my skin.
You have to go to
Best Buy or anything else. They're gone. They're all gone.
It's amazing, because I had a bookstore that I used to visit for Christmas every year to do signing, and you're right. They closed up shop. Right? They're just not making the margins that the mall requires to pay the rent.
The B. Daltons and the Walton books used to always be in there. Then there was always, you know, your local record store that you could go to. Gone. You know, they're not making it anymore. And why do you think Barnes & Noble's up for sale? It's not because they're making a profit. You don't sell when you're making a profit. You're selling because you're losing money. You know, Borders is losing money. And I heard that Borders might be trying to buy out Barnes & Noble. That's,
yeah, I've been waiting for Borders to fall apart.
I know. Now they're going to buy Barnes & Noble.
Yeah. That sounds a little scary to me.
I don't get it. But, and I think the whole social networking platform is also great. and wonderful. So, but you know what? There's a caller on here. CJ, you want to take a quick question? I don't know what they're going to ask because I don't have a producer. So let's see. Caller, you are on the air to ask a question.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, my name is Regis Shulkin.
Hey, Regis, how you doing again?
I'm doing very well. I have a question for Mr. West.
Go right ahead.
Hi, Regis.
The question is, in writing some of your stories, do you ever feel that in some way you may suggest ways to commit crimes that you feel bad about?
You know, that's an excellent question. And I'll tell you a story. And I did feel bad about this. There's a scene in one of my books that is a little outrageous. And it's a threesome scene. And someone about 2 years after I wrote that book, I discovered that someone had read the book and then gone out and done that. And that really troubled me for a while. And that was really my motivation to write A Demon Awaits, which is a story about someone finding redemption. I think I shy away from helping people do particular crimes in terms of breaking in. You know, I don't get into lock-picking technology for that reason. One of the things that I did, though, in the book Sin and Vengeance is Randy Black is a scary guy. I don't know if you've read that book, John, but he's a wonderful character to write, but he's a very scary guy, and he does some evil things to a $2 million house that he basically destroys. And I felt like I gave some people some really, really awful ideas of things they could do to torment someone. But I do shy away from specific things like, you know, I wouldn't teach somebody how to commit computer crime. I don't think that's something that I want to go out and help people do in part of my books. And I also stay away from sort of the policeman spy. I'm really focused on sort of your everyman in difficult situations.
Well, thanks a lot, Regis, for calling in and asking CJ the question. And CJ, you didn't, I don't know if you went back and heard the interview that I did with Brad Thor here on Blog Talk Radio, which was, I asked him, you know, because I know he's very political, and I wanted to know as far as he's surprised that we haven't had any attacks, and, you know, what he think would be like the next big thing that could possibly happen. And he mentioned that he could see like 50 different people walking into movie theaters, taking a backpack, putting it under their seat, walking out of the theater, and simultaneously all 50 of them just kind of, you know, blow up around the United States. And it's like, scares the hell out of me.
Yeah, you know, I think there are some simple ideas. If I were to attack the United States, I would be very successful, I think. But I'm really not going to share that knowledge with anyone, especially not the public way, because I don't want to sabotage my own country. I think that's really irresponsible to do. And it's not something I'm going to do. You know, I don't want to put people here at risk. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, it was just one of those things where I think that, you know, people were, you know, I don't know how long ago they were talking about maybe, you know, the whole flying of planes into buildings or anything like that. But, you know, it is. And the reason why we kind of got on that talk was just because of the complacency of people. You know, it's only 9 years away from, you know, 9/11. And I think people have just kind of forgotten. And now you hear people complaining about, you know, walking through the airport and, you know, full body scans or being checked and security and this and that. Da, da, da. Don't they realize what happened 9 years ago and that a little inconvenience of 30 minutes is well worth, you know, anything else maybe happening, and going through a metal detector is not an invasion of anybody's privacy. I don't think going through a body scan is an invasion of anybody's privacy. I think that those are the same people that if something were to happen, they'd be like, why didn't they stop it, or why couldn't they fix it, or da-da-da-da-da. So I don't feel, you know, any invasion of privacy, because frankly, I don't do anything wrong like that, so it doesn't bug me.
Right, you know,
I'm not one of those big guys like that.
Yeah, I have a little different view on that. And I'm fine going through the full body scanner. I don't know if I want my daughters going through the full body scanner or my girlfriend or my wife or something like that. And I think one of the things that we really miss as a society is situational awareness. I think we've come to count on the police and the government to protect us. We're really not aware of our surroundings.
Right.
I've done a lot of hunting in my lifetime, and that really does make you situationally aware. If something moves, you pick it up, and you pay attention at a much more detailed level to things around you. You're just tuned in, and so many people, you know, that just don't get what's going on around them at the most basic level. And I think that's something that we could all do to really help, especially when we're traveling, be situationally aware of, you know, what's happening in the space around us the whole time from, you know, you leave the house to arrive at the destination. That would change a whole lot of
stuff. Yeah, and I don't think stereotyping or racial profiling is something that needs to be happening, because sometimes that kind of gets in the way, I think. But it is, you know, for years, people always say that even eyewitnesses to crimes aren't the most reliable because they really weren't paying that much attention. And maybe they didn't see what they thought they saw, and things kind of changed, and you could go in there and do that. But, you know, I do think that it's up to the people to just, like you said, be a lot more aware of the situation, the surroundings, the things that you are doing. And a lot of it would stop, or it just would never happen.
Right, we'd be aware. You know, I had a great event with Anthony Ritchie. The video's on my website, and it's actually a cool video. He's driving me backwards through an obstacle course. I'm not sure if you saw that one. But
I did. That was interesting.
That was really cool. You know, I was filming through the dashboard, and he's going 40 miles an hour backwards, swerving around a very curvy track. It was an amazing ride. But before that, he gave a lecture for an hour on situational awareness in driving and kidnap situations and that sort of thing. And it was really eye-opening, the details that you should be looking for that he gave us. People walked away really, really amazed at the things he could teach us in just within, 30, 45 minutes. It was really, really cool. But yeah, situational awareness is key.
Well, I'll tell you what, CJ, your website is 22, that's 22wb.com, and your book's out here. The one that you have going on right now is The End of Marking Time, and it's your standalone book. You also have, your three Randy Black books here. And when you said Send Inventions, that was your first Randy Black novel, so I didn't know that that was actually your first book that you wrote. So you started out with Randy and not your standalone. So.
Actually, I wrote Taking Stock but didn't publish it.
Okay. So
and
that's why you have it listed that way. I think that's why I was confused. So.
Right. It's confusing to everyone, including me. I wrote Taking Stock first, and that was a novel that a lot of writers would have put in the drawer. And then I wrote Sin and Vengeance and got some great reaction, published that. What I did is I went back and threw away the text of Taking Stock and started again. And rewrote the entire book. And it came out to be a much better book, much different book. And that's why that was published in the order it was.
Yeah, and the great thing is what you do is you don't get complacent with your writing. Is it's always something that's different, where, there's a lot of writers out there, they get complacent with their character, and it's just kind of the same, the same story just told in a different way. And that doesn't happen because, The End of Marking Time is something that is just, like I said, it's scary. And it's something that I've never seen a book like that before, how it's written, and, the development and the plot behind it. So,
It kind of blows the top of your head off when you get to the end.
Yeah. I mean, and you're sitting there scratching your head, and somebody sat there, on your site, it was perfect. They wrote that this book troubled me. Hours after I finished reading it, you're still thinking about it, and there's no easy answers in the book. But that's the case. You're still thinking about it. Hours after, days after, you're like, what? What? Yeah.
Yeah, I have people, you know, when I first put that book out, people flocked to my page. They wanted to talk about the book and the implications. You know, a lot of people have said, you know, every college student in America should read this book, and really excited about what it says about society, and that really is exciting to me. You know, back to your point about my books and how they relate to each other, one of the things that I do is, you know, every book is different. The ending of every book is different. I write some books that have a happily ever after ending. I have some cliffhanger endings, and then I have some endings like The End of Marking Time where you just really don't see it coming, and you scratch your head and think about it for a while.
Right.
And, you know, I want people, when they're reading my books, not to say, well, I know how this is going to end, because, you know, most of the time you don't. You know, and people who have read all of my books know, you know, I might give them a happy ending, or I might not. So I guess it really puts some thrill into thriller.
And that's the whole idea. You don't want to pick up, you know, another book from another author, an author that's written, you know, the same character 12 times, and you know exactly how it's going to end. I mean, maybe they get there a little different direction, but it's still, it's the same, you know, motion as they go through. It's just, you know, I just find it boring, and I only go on so long with a character before it's like, okay, either you have to change it up or you have to do something.
Right, you know, Randy Black and Sid and Vengeance is the villain, and he does some horrible things. People wanted to kill Randy, and when I wrote A Demon Awaits is the story of Randy Black coming to terms with what he's done and becoming an anti-hero. So, huge transformation. A lot of people didn't want to read that book from his perspective because they absolutely hated it.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, I'm willing to do some things that, you know, are a little risky. I guess The End of Marking Time was a bit of a risk as well.
You got to push the envelope.
Right. I feel like I'm pushing the envelope. I feel like I'm doing things that are challenging to me. A Deep in the Waste was really a challenge to me to change people's minds about Randy Black. And when I started writing that book, I wasn't sure if I could do it. I wasn't sure if I could get them to embrace him as a character or if they would put the book down. And
right.
It turns out that people really thought differently about him when they were done, and that was really satisfying for me because, you know, I wasn't sure that I could accomplish that over the course of the novel.
Well, CJ, it has been such a pleasure to have you on. Look forward to seeing who you get to interview next on your radio show that we can listen to, and you know, see what else is going to come out from, you know, what you're doing. Checking out your daughter's work again. It's 22wb.com. Find you on Facebook, and you know, you are definitely one of the authors that is changing the landscape of how, you know, things are going to be done in the future, which is awesome. So thanks so much for coming on.
John, thank you for having me. I look forward to coming back again, and I'll see you soon.
All right. Have a good one. So everybody, that's CJ West. Again, you can check him out at 22wb.com. That is the numbers 22 to see what he is up to. He is definitely an entrepreneur and head of on the publishing of everything that's going on. I hope everybody enjoyed the conversation. A lot of eye-opening material out there if you're an author, if you're a reader, if you're an inspiring author. You know, hopefully we gave you a lot of good information. So, SuspenseMagazine.com, check out everything that we do out there. Our magazine is available on the shelves. You know, if you need any questions or anything, go ahead and email us, editor@SuspenseMagazine.com. All on Friday night, where we're going to have another debut author night going on here. And so, everybody, it's been a pleasure, and we'll see you all on Friday night. Good night, everybody.